Residents of Sarapee District, Chiang Mai Province, have the highest rate of lung cancer in the country. Every year, for 2 to 3 months, Sarapee, Chiang Mai, and the entire northern region of Thailand, as well as large areas of Laos and Burma, suffocate under smoke. To contextualize this, let's look at the air quality index during the Canadian wildfires of 2023. Which have a Wikipedia page, by the way. So air quality is measured by PPM, parts per million. Basically, it puts a number on the unwanted particles in the air. Anything over 50 PPM is considered unhealthy. At its worst, the pollution affecting cities like Chicago and Minneapolis during the wildfires were measured at 256 and 228, respectively. This lasted for around 2 days and made international headlines. Comparatively, a few years back, the city of Chiang Rai measured an index of over 300 for 9 consecutive weeks. There is no Wikipedia page. And this happens every year. This annual climate apocalypse is a relatively new phenomenon, beginning around 20 years ago and rapidly increasing in intensity. The cause, in my opinion, is a conspiracy. This conspiracy is a product of a decades-long interplay between state and capital, the birthing of mass agribusiness, monopolization, vertical integration of markets, of coups, of massacres in the streets, and of networks of dark finance and patronage. This is what I call the corn conspiracy. Because in short, the toxic hell is caused, really, by the burning of agricultural byproduct. That is to say, clearing fields of agricultural waste with fire in order to plant for the next season's crops. The main offender, I will tell you up front now, being corn, or maize as it's also known. Something which has been obfuscated behind a smoke screen by the powers that facilitated it. The more research one reads into the topic, the more apparent the obfuscation becomes. Clear inaccuracies and contradictions in reporting appear time and time again. This is particularly egregious when one actually lives in the affected region. For example, in nearly every article I've seen, northern farmers burning sugarcane has been blamed for the smoke pollution in the north. However, I have never, nor has anyone I know, seen a sugarcane plant in the region. And I've been here for 10 years. And others were born here. They've never seen one. Eerie, no? The annual climate catastrophe traces its origins back to Siam's spell as a rice bowl for the region under the grip of the British Empire. They, and the successor empire of the United States, went on to develop Thailand's lands and its bourgeois class to ensure this extractive arrangement continued. The tentacles of market relations would eventually reach into the hills, tear down the forests, sow the corn, and set it alight. Today, when we look into the skies over the hills, we see a grey smog. Hiding behind the grey is a network of elite financiers, petty bourgeois intermediaries, and military strongmen. I talked about this in all of the past 3 seasons of this podcast. In many ways, this mini-series is a follow-up to our last episode on agricultural practices and counterinsurgency. In that series, we saw how agricultural practices developed in line with decades of counterinsurgency policies. We saw how mass agribusiness was birthed out of the global anti-communist restructuring of Asia during the supposed Cold War. In this mini-series, we're going to focus on one of the many outcomes of this development. In the agriculturally induced annual environmental catastrophe, which is the deadly smog season. I hope to answer a couple of key questions that I'm often asked, such as, how and why does this happen? and why can't anyone seem to do anything about it? So, let's take a deep breath of grey air and get into it. Hi, it is currently April 2024 in the north, in the hills, and the smoke is finally lifting after 2 months of suffocating, blanketing grey air. We weren't planning on making this series, and I was kind of reticent to, because to be honest, the whole subject is quite a bummer, and really, really complicated as well. And oftentimes I feel like I'm just moaning when I complain about it. But if you'll bear with my moans, at least for the first part of this episode, I think we can learn quite a lot about mass agribusiness and generally the relationship between capital, the state, and the people, particularly peasants, through looking at the smoke. I also don't think this is going to be a very long series, maybe just 2 episodes. We're actually in the middle of writing a series about the Tamador, the Burmese military, so do hold on for that. For now though, as I said, it's April and the smoke is still here, though it is getting a little better. This year actually hasn't been as bad as the past few, and we'll get into why later. But there were some extremely rough days in the past few months where the grey air was so thick that the sun no longer cast a shadow. So I'm going to start by talking about what it's like in the smoke, which is pretty bleak. But do bear with me, it will get more interesting and instructive as we go on, because there is some light behind these smoggy clouds. So, what are we talking about when we talk about smoke? Well, just to state my credentials, I moved to these northern hills in 2014, so I've lived through more than a few seasons. So in late January, it's when the air starts to get a little hazy. Nothing too scary, but the mountains in the distance have a kind of white fade between you and them. By late February, the fade grows more intense. Oftentimes, it won't have rained for over a month, and the forest begins to dry out. Dry leaves begin to blanket the roadsides. The occasional wind whips up dust and debris. It's then that you'll likely see a few fields undergoing controlled burning, with balaclava-clad workers standing by. In England, this used to be called clearing the stubble. Not only fields, but I've also seen plenty of burning of just piles of leaf debris by the roadside, for example. March is when it gets really bad. You start to lose sight of the mountain. The temperature rises to the high 30 degrees. People start putting on masks. You start to notice your scratchy throat and stinging eyes. By April, it's hell. 40 degrees and the smoke is so thick you can look directly at the sun. On bad days, there are no shadows. It's a very eerie feeling to look at the weather app where it shows the sun on a blue sky background, but outside, the sky is purely grey. Those who can afford it use air purifiers, which are these kind of machines that look like dehumidifiers, which cleans the air in the room. I sleep with one on, and when I leave the bedroom every morning, I can instantly smell the smoke inside of the house. You quickly get used to the smell, though. I was talking to a friend in Kuala Lumpur this year, who was just baffled that I couldn't actually ever really smell it. Last year, I went to Bangkok for a week during the smoke season, and when I opened my suitcase, all of a sudden it hit me, and it just reeked of smoke. So this is where we get into the different class-based experiences of the smoke. For me, I am solidly middle income, though I used to be way broker for the first few years I was here. And so for me today, the air purifiers are essential. They cost around 3,000 baht, that's about 75 euros. However, a lot of houses don't have much in the way of insulation, I live in a relatively modern house, and a couple of my windows are just like slats, you know, that don't permanently close, and I plug them up annually. The less well-off have just grates that are incapable of closing entirely or being blocked off. So even if they could afford a purifier, it wouldn't be of much use. For the working class too, most work outside, all day, every day. The biggest sector for employment here is by far and away agriculture and agriculture-related industries, so like maybe truck drivers or sellers of farming equipment, repair people, that kind of stuff. And like I said, while I have the luxury of hiding inside, the agricultural workers are outside, all day, every day. The same goes for masks. I spent about 400 baht on an N95 mask, which I wear outside. Poorer people wear those near useless blue masks, while those working outside all day, I notice, often don't bother wearing anything at all, and who can blame them? The effects of the smoke are cumulative. It gets worse as it goes on. After a month, you start getting migraines, nosebleeds, coughs. Last year, a panda at Chiang Mai Zoo was pictured with blood pouring from its nose. It died a few weeks later. As I said in the opening, Sarapee District has the highest rate of lung cancer in the country. That fact was reported a few weeks ago with very little additional information. But Sarapee is also one of the poorest districts in the Greater Chiang Mai area and makes up the city's industrial zone to the southeast, home to migrant workers from the countryside and from Burma. In the villages themselves, life is lived outdoors. Both work and leisure, farming, eating, often sleeping even outdoors. Not that inside is any better in the typically wooden houses of the rural poor. As for the upper and the upper middle class, I'm not sure what exactly to call them, you know, like upper income people, they just leave. Maybe they go to Bangkok, which is usually where they're from, or they go to the south, to the coast, to the beaches, places like Hua Hin and Phuket. Certainly, almost all foreigners do this. The rest of us stay behind in the quiet streets. No one goes out much, and it can be oddly peaceful at times in the grey hell. So, why is it this bad, and how did it get this bad? To answer that question, I want to use a word that I think I've used before on the show, but maybe never explained, and that is latifundia. The word latifundia originally comes from the Roman Empire, referring to the agricultural plantations on the empire's periphery that were worked by slave labor in order to provide huge enough surpluses to feed the rest of the empire. The plantations would seek to expand their lands and increase their slave holdings, constantly seeking new fields and labor for a greater surplus. These latifundia were the proto-models of imperial governance and industrialized agriculture. Indeed, there is a direct chain, as the Spanish and the Portuguese even use the word latifundios to refer to their slave plantations in colonial Latin America. Today, the word is used typically by those in kind of third worldist global south context to refer to places where intense industrialized agriculture takes place. The likes of the Brazilian cattle farms, the Moroccan fruit farms, the Kenyan tea plantations, and oftentimes the Southeast Asian rice paddies. One key facet of the modern day latifundia is the vast surplus of agricultural product created. That is to say, far more agricultural produce than can be used in the local economy, as of course the produce is intended for export, like the Roman latifundia of old. The fact that this is export-driven agriculture is essential for understanding its insatiable appetite for expansion. In more traditional, sustainable farming communities, only a small surplus was necessary to feed the local people. Hence, there was no need to drive expansion further. And this may sound antiquated, but these kind of localized economies of self-sufficiency still exist on a national scale. For example, in the UK milk industry, which is heavily regulated by the state, it produces just about the right amount of milk for the UK economy. As such, there is, relatively speaking, very little import or export of milk in the UK. It sounds a little strange, but the UK milk industry is a sustainable domestic agricultural economy. Similarly, somewhere like the UK is, of course, outside of the milk industry, the UK is the imperial core, to where the agricultural surplus of the latifundia flows. Having said that, latifundias are not simply poor places that do farming. There are plenty of places in the global south that would not meet the definition, such as Sierra Leone's fruit farms, or even Vietnam's coffee plantations. These economies are also plundered by the imperial core, but crucially, not particularly for a massive agricultural surplus, rather for other products, like iron ore in Sierra Leone, or sweatshop garments and factory workers in Vietnam. In many of these global south economies, agricultural products are generally self-sustained, like the milk industry in the UK. In short, it's more economically productive to grow food for the workers in other industries within the domestic economy than it is to use that economic capacity to create a massive surplus of food for export. Does that make sense? Okay, I'm going to go off my notes here. So my workers in the factories, in the sweatshops, in the mines can earn more money for my economy if they're doing that rather than growing massive amounts of surplus food. So in my agricultural sector, I'm going to use it to feed those workers in the factories and in the mines. Yeah, that makes sense, right? So there are even plenty of places in Europe that we could define as latifundia, such as the flatlands in the east of Romania or the greenhouses in southern Spain. So this definition of latifundia is by no means scientific. Oftentimes, it can be highly debatable. It's a consequence or a confluence of a series of political, economic, and geographic circumstances that allows a latifundia to develop. And this we will get into later. Again then, it is in the latifundias that the economic fixation on industrialized, export-driven mass agriculture creates this huge pressure for increasing surplus and increasingly expand fields. And finally then, we find ourselves back in the hills of northern Thailand, but not the paddy fields of the valley, but in the cleared forest, the corn plantations on the slopes of the hills. You know, it's interesting, actually, when I first moved here in 2014, a lot of people tended to blame the smoke on mushroom foraging, which was absolutely bullshit. People claimed that, actually they would usually say, hill tribes burn the rice fields to encourage the growth of these certain mushrooms, which is almost 100% bullshit, is a nugget of truth. In that, like, these mushrooms do grow in burnt paddy fields, but my god, the hill people who live in the hills don't even grow rice, and that has nothing to do with the mass smog. Similarly, I've heard people blame god. Okay, sugarcane, wrong. Laotian farmers, wrong. Slash and burn farming, wrong. Rice fields in general, wrong. And even shabu restaurants, I remember the first year I moved here, I heard that. Also wrong. And I am going to bust many of these myths in more detail later. And of course, we cannot blame a commodity per se. It's not the commodity's fault. Neither can we, as reasonable people, blame those who produce or even consume that commodity. No. We have to blame the system that affords the smoke to come from that commodity. And we will in due time. But the commodity in question, as I've said before, is of course corn or maize. And here I'm just going to say I will be using the word corn to refer to both corn and maize, even though it's not strictly accurate, but both are responsible. And just for my own relief, I'll be saying corn. You don't need to worry about it. So, corn. Listeners to the show will know how I loathe it, though it is by no means corn's fault. And I do actually quite enjoy eating corn, particularly tam kao pod. But in short, yes, it's corn. Hence the corn conspiracy. And we'll be busting down some of the lies about those innocent mushrooms later. And though this conspiracy is disputed and refuted in some circles, I am highly confident, and I intend to show my workings. So first, let's take a look at corn. The plants are tall, nearly 2 meters, tightly wrapped with layered leaves and stems, and the kernels, the seeds themselves, are then attached to the cob. For corn, the kernels are the only thing you want, those yellow or sometimes white and purple seeds. As such, harvesting creates a huge amount of organic waste for the return of usable product. Despite the waste, it is a relatively non-labor intensive crop compared to, say, rice. Corn seeds can be sown in the weak red highland soil, the dindang. There, they require little to no irrigation. Their annual rainy season, followed by winter and the dry season, provides the plant with the necessary conditions to produce a crop. Harvesting, too, is relatively easy. You wait for the dry season to wither the plants away, and the stalks just fall down, leaving the husks amongst the leaves to be easily picked up and thrown in sacks by hand. I know I say this is easy, which again, it is relatively easy, relatively speaking, compared to rice or vegetables. Rice requires more monitoring, a more constant and stable water supply, and more delicate harvesting labor. Rice is also more at risk from parasites and pests, while vegetables are extremely tricky to grow en masse. Again, due to pests and any fluctuating climate contingencies, say too much sun or too much rain or too little of both. Corn isn't like that. Corn is tough, hardy. It's much better at taking care of itself. Unlike fruit and vegetables, once harvested, corn can be dried and stored for lengthy periods of time. It can be easily weighed and checked for quality en masse. The harvested kernels stack up tightly, meaning it can also be easily shipped, requiring no refrigeration. The dried kernels are highly versatile. They can be rehydrated as food for humans. They can be milled into flour. They can be turned into biofuels or starches. And most commonly, and most importantly for us, they can be turned into animal feed. In all these regards, corn is a wonder crop, particularly when you put it up against something as fickle and finicky as, say, tomatoes. The only problem for those of us in the hills is the massive amount of waste, the material product produced by the plant, the stems, the leaves, the husks. To plant the next year's crop, you have to clear the cornfields of that waste. For this, there are only 3 options. 1. Intense labor application. So that would be humans themselves clearing the land by hand with machetes, hoes, and canvas bags, and stuffing them with waste and transporting them down the mountain, possibly by hand as well even. 2. Advanced machinery, like combine harvesters and tractors with plows, to plow the waste material back into the soil. and free, fire burning the stubble. So let's break down the issues. Problem one with intense labor application. Well, that's quite an easy one to write off. It would take a literal army of strong, abled people to do such a job, and that labor capacity simply doesn't exist in the villages. Problem two, the advanced machinery. Here in my notes, I've simply written lull. So the most advanced machinery you'll find in those cornfields is probably a motorbike, maybe with a sidecar. And even those can't make it up many of the steep, narrow, dirty slopes most of the time. So a combine harvester or a tractor doing so is quite laughable. Problem three, fire. Well, the only risk is that the fire gets out of control and spreads to the forest. And yep, that's what happens. Now, whether the regional blanket of smoke is caused by smoke from the corn or actually smoke from the consequential unintended forest fires is unknown. Maybe, you know, a little bit of both. But nonetheless, due to the geography of the region, the high mountain ridges and the low valleys, the smoke has nowhere to go. During the dry season, the air is stagnant. There is no wind nor rain to speak of, nothing to disperse it, until the rains begin again in late April. Anyway, so looking at this economically, there is only one solution to clearing the waste, and that's fire. And where there's fire, there's smoke. Okay. So let's say you're sticking with me for now. So the north is a corn latifundia. Okay, so why here? Why now? Why corn? And how did it come to be? Many of these answers can be found in our last series on counterinsurgency, where we looked at the parallel lines of agricultural development and counterinsurgency policy. In that series, we somewhat dropped the narrative at the turn of the millennium, and here it is where our corn conspiracy really begins. So I'll do a quick recap and we can pick it up again. So at the dawn of the modern era, I hate that word, let's say post-World War II, Thailand was basically a big rice bowl, and much of the rice land, the wet rice cultivation paddies, were incapable of expanding. Rice, like I said before, can be quite a delicate crop. You need to have a flat land with large amounts of irrigation, unless you're willing to put in the decades of labor that was able to construct those beautiful terraced fields you see famously in places like Sapa in Vietnam. So, the Thai agricultural economy had nowhere to go. The forest was thick, often mountainous, and the sole property of the monarchy. The paddy fields were owned by the elite landlords, and the international trading markets were not yet developed enough to ship a pineapple grown in Thailand to the supermarket shelves of Paris. It was during the social tensions of the supposed Cold War in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, while the Thai communist insurgency was active, that the state and capital worked hand in glove to facilitate clearances of forest land, to open up new spaces of cultivation, extraction, and simultaneously, new markets. This was done so as to release the pressure valve of economic stagnation and social unrest in both urban and rural areas. They did this by the monarchy, or the state, giving away parcels of forested land for farmers to clear. This is what the last series was all about, and do go and give all seven episodes a listen if you have a minute. But basically, if you were a landless peasant or a broke urban worker, and you were offered free land somewhere in the countryside, you would absolutely go and take it, rather than take the risk of joining an insurrection. Thailand was once, at the time, described as America's 51st state, a bulwark of anti-communism in the Southeast Asian Sea of Red. The Americans had poured massive manpower and resources into enforcing the Thai elite against its workers and peasantry, developing an intricate gladio-esque network of anti-communist death squads, intelligence apparatuses, massive propaganda efforts, a powerful central state core in Bangkok, and facilitating the opening of the economy to the global markets. In the 1970s, a well-organized peasant movement emerged, the Farmers' Federation of Thailand. While the group was national, its heartlands were in the north. To quote Andrew Turton on the movement, writing in the Journal of Peasant Studies, he said, quote, "Some demanded for immediate action, such as grants of land for coming planting seasons, price regulation, reduction of farm debts, suspension of court cases involving farmers, release of those arrested for trespassing, and help for flood victims. Other demands were longer term, such as those for land reform and a permanent provision of land for the landless, and a solution to the problems of indebtedness and high interest rates. Some demands were more immediately political, such as the lifting of martial law." End of quote. This sudden upsurge in politicized peasant organizing struck fear into the land-owning class and their crony enforcers within the military. The peasantry had long been seen as a vulnerable target to communist subversion. It was during this organizing that the death squads were activated and an assassination campaign against the peasants began. Many of these death squads had been directly and indirectly formed by the US state, most notably by Bill Donovan, founding father of the CIA and post-World War II ambassador to Thailand. At the height of the assassination campaign, between March and August 1975, 21 Farmers' Federation leaders were killed, the majority of them in the north. It's unclear exactly how many assassinations can be attributed to the campaign overall, but the immediate effect was the decapitation of the Federation. This was concluded with the massacre at Thammasat University in 1976, with a death toll well into the hundreds. The message to peasants and anyone else politically organizing against the repressive state and the capitalist class was chillingly clear. Following the assassination campaign and the defeat of the Communist Party Thailand insurgency in 1983, the peasants effectively lost all bargaining power. They were to be left at the mercy of the landlord classes and the extractive markets. This, along with the simultaneous blossoming of the Green Revolution, the fertilizers and the farming technologies and the complex international trade networks, it facilitated farmers or landlords to make farmers plant new types of crops for market in the freshly cleared forest lands. Here, I will again quote from perhaps my favorite political ecology paper of all time, Larry Lohmann's Land, Power, and Forest Colonization in Thailand, published in 1993. This is something of my Thai political ecology Bible. So, to quote, "Patron-client networks, together with farmers' desires for advancement, agricultural extension, malaria eradication programs, and other factors, have articulated with the new export economy to induce more farmers into the forest. Since the 1960s, merchants, millers, traders in forest products, timber companies, speculators, and strongmen have engaged and financed a large proportion of settlers who have cleared the forests in eastern, central, lower north, and northeast regions, which are then planted with maize, sugarcane, cassava, rubber, and eucalyptus. These new rural patrons have provided marketing, seeds, and credit available at monthly interest rates of 5% or more to buy food or hire labor and tractors. Mainstream sources of credit for this are often not available." End of quote. So he's saying that these patronage networks were what facilitated the expansion of agricultural lands into the forest. These patrons are named as, to quote again, merchants, millers, traders in forest products, timber companies, speculators, and strongmen. So in short, the petty bourgeois intermediaries of the capitalist class and their cronies. Continuing to quote here, quote, production and legal and market hazards are in large part passed on to the individual growers, who have to turn over their output to agribusiness in exchange for costly inputs. As in other patronage-mediated systems, further clearances of land often follows, whether to clear debts or to provide more income in a cash economy. Such factors have been combined with land deprivation to draw ever more settlers into the forest. This deprivation can be ascribed to roughly four causes related to the patterns of economic development promoted by the Thai state and its international benefactors. The first is economic differentiation, the accumulation of land and other resources in the hands of a minority, and the migration of the deprived seeking new access to them. This pressure is then subject to a positive feedback from environmental degradation resulting from the cultivation of migrant-cleared upland forests, and from cultural change undermining previous protective attitudes towards local land and forest. Thirdly, outright seizure or enclosure of land by elites for economically productive purposes, such as logging or plantations, forces still more peasants into forest colonization. Finally, rising land prices and speculation make it difficult even for those smallholders who have kept control of their fields to resist pressures to sell and move on elsewhere. So that was a little speed run, but what we can see here is that latifundian pressure that I was talking about earlier. This pressure, which necessitates the mass expansion of agricultural land and pushing that expansion to the absolute limit, both geographically and through labor extraction. Lohmann describes how the pressure on peasants from creditors, buyers, and local elites forces them into clearing more and more forest for crop space, with ever-increasing debt forever chasing them. I think it's really important to highlight another point that he made earlier on there, where he said, quote, provide more income in a cash economy. And the best example I like to use for this is that as new technologies and products come to the market, some become essential, like, for example, Wi-Fi or a monthly phone bill, which costs around 600 to 1,000 baht per month. I think we can all agree that it is essential to have Wi-Fi or a phone nowadays. So that's something like an extra 12,000 baht per year per household, when a typical monthly income in those areas is about 12,000 baht. So that would be a 10% increase in cost per year that literally didn't exist before. Now, since that paper was published in 1993, I will have to take over the narrative from here. In 1997, the Tom Yum Goong market crash devastated the economy, resulting in a mass movement of people out of urban areas and back into their rural hometowns. In 2001, Thaksin Shinawatra's Thai Rak Thai Party was elected, in large part thanks to their base, the rural poor and the lower middle classes in the rural areas. Thai Rak Thai built a vast state welfare network, provided huge rural development policies, and alleviated the poverty of millions of the rural poor. There was an economic boom. People bought trucks, tractors, built new houses, opened new businesses, and so on and so forth. Just after 5 years after the election, however, there was, of course, a military coup against Thai Rak Thai, leading to over a decade of political instability and throwing the economy in and out of economic crises. All of those investments made by rural people totally bottomed out, throwing them into debt. And this is an extremely common family narrative, you know, like, oh, my family were doing well in Thaksin time, they invested, and then the economy went to shit, and now we're in big debt. Generational debt nowadays. So even within our Dindang group of about 10 people, I think around half of the families fit this description. So the economic effects of these crises were, of course, felt most profoundly by the rural poor. Household debt skyrocketed from 40% of GDP at the time of the coup to 90% in 2021. Now remember what Larry Lohman said earlier, to requote it, quote, "Production and legal and market hazards are in large part passed on to individual growers who have to turn over their output to agribusiness in exchange for costly inputs. As in other patronage-mediated systems, further clearances of land often follows, whether to clear debts or to provide more income in the cash economy." So I think that first sentence was very important to highlight too. Production and legal and market hazards are in large part passed on to individual growers. This is the agribusiness practice of the big companies not actually owning the land that's being farmed. Indeed, they don't want to own the land. Rather, it's in their interest for the peasants to own the land and hence bear any risks from the fluctuating markets that make land ownership and farming so risky, such as bad harvests. And even then, it's better, it's like, I didn't write this in the notes, I just remembered, it's better if you've got your workers in debt, you know, because then they have less bargaining power against you. So what we see in the first two decades of the 2000s is a massive increase in household debt, which pushes farmers into further land clearances and field creations. Okay. Then let's stick that beside corn production. So between 2002 and 2022, corn planting for animal feed increased around 400%, while simultaneously household debt increased by 200%. To circle back then to how we started this section, the anti-communist policies of the Cold War, of clearing land for intense agricultural use so as to ease the internal socio-political and economic pressures, are directly responsible for starting and maintaining the policies forcing the peasants into growing corn and these agricultural practices that facilitated this toxic latifundia. Now, as I said before, it is a confluence of factors that facilitate the smoke. I kind of see it like a river with different streams joining and increasing the water pressure along the way. So far, we've examined just a few of these streams. It takes just a confluence of two to make a river. Let's say so far we've looked at the corn crop and the land clearances, but there are more streams to uncover. Streams which feed into this conspiracy. The land clearances of the Cold War, the opening up of the forested frontier for settlers, was absolutely a conspiracy at the time, one orchestrated by the state, capital, and the American Empire. Again, in the last series, we went far deeper into the role of the American intelligence, state planners, and academic institutions in instituting these policies behind closed doors. The purpose of this was to ensure the continued extractionist imperial policies of the West towards what was then called the Third World. Thailand was, in a very literal sense, decommunized and primed to become the modern plantation, the latifundia that it is today. It was, without question, and by definition, a conspiracy. But that's just part one of the corn conspiracy. In the next episode, we're going to bust some myths, shoot down some flack. We're going to talk about the hall of mirrors one inevitably finds themselves wandering through when looking for a way out of the smoke. Slash and burn practices, hunting, urban snobbery, Laotian farmers, cross-border smoke, forest fires, and just how little money corn actually accounts for. More importantly though, we're going to talk about sugarcane. And I do encourage you to go and look into what supposedly causes this smoke. because almost every article and academic paper I can find says sugarcane, bar a few. And in the 10 years I've been in these hills, I have not seen a single plant. Look beyond the smoke and the sugarcane leaves, friends, and see the corn for what it is. And see you next time.